My guest today is Liam Nilsson. It is Liam's third time on Off Trail Learning. The first time we were talking about the Endor Initiative, which was an agile learning center that he started in Asheville, North Carolina. The second time was about who should unschool and who shouldn't. And this time it's about reading. And we have to start with the elephant in the room. Liam, you were unschooled your whole life. Can you even read?
I was, Blake, and I can now. Yes. I was somewhat of a late reader. I was 9 when I learned how to read. I had an older brother who I spent a lot of time with, and I would just point to things and he would read them to me. So I think that was a bit of a crutch that I had. But then as a 9-year-old, I think partially out of social shame from my schooled friends, I like really pushed myself and then learned how to read. And then read a lot. Then I started reading like almost a book a day for a couple of years. And, and then as a teenager, started working.
A book a day for a couple of years?
Well, okay. Sorry.
What kind of books are we talking about?
That's
very impressive.
Like British teen novels.
All right.
So it was not like I was, you know, tearing through the classics or anything like that. Maybe not a book a day. I was certain days I was reading an entire book. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. All right. And then in your teen years. Right. Then in my teen years, I started working at a library and continued to read quite a lot, and then continued amassing books because all the books that the library would throw away, I would get to look through them and bring them home if I wanted them before they made it to the dumpster. So that's when I really started kind of hoarding books too. So sometimes in conversations about kind of self-directed education, I've told this story to people without revealing that I'm the protagonist in the story, that like I knew somebody who didn't even learn how to read until they were 9. But then once they did, they started reading more than, you know, everybody else they knew, and even worked at a library for many years. And then, you know, depending on where the conversation goes from there, I'll do the big reveal that
I love
that kid was me.
Yeah. It's like the story. The story is about unschoolers who play a lot of video games and then become like famous video game developers, or don't touch math for a long time and then go to graduate school for pure math.
Yeah, but I still haven't published a book though. I feel like I'd claim that one if I had published something.
You still have time, Liam.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
True. Just for everyone's context, how old are you now, Liam?
I am 28.
28 years young.
Yeah.
Excellent. And you were unschooled your whole life. You were raised in Connecticut and also Norway, yep. But that was only when you were younger, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a 4-year-old, I moved to Connecticut, to Stamford, right outside of New York City, in the greater New York metropolitan area. Lived there until I was 18, and then moved back to Norway for a while. Moved back to the States, lived in North Carolina for a while, and then moved to Denmark, which is where I still live now, 5 years later. Yeah, but I just had my 5-year anniversary here.
Ah, congratulations. Yeah. So we are going to talk about the relationship between self-directed education or unschooling and reading, but we're going to talk about that later in the interview. The main thrust is just going to be you and I discussing how we learn through reading, mm-hmm. since it's such like a primary mechanism for how all people learn. And I just thought it would be extremely interesting to talk about the nitty gritty of how we approach reading, how we read, where we find books, what books have influenced us, all of that stuff that happens around reading, but just gets encapsulated in this very simple word, reading. So that's where we're going to go.
Cool. Sounds good.
Let's start with just talking about books that have changed our lives. books that stand out as like this represents like a peak reading experience to me. And you and I were each supposed to do some prep for this episode. I'm going to put you on the spot first. And
okay,
go ahead. Good luck.
Right. Yeah. So right, you asked me to make that list, and I have to admit, I do not have one definitive list of all the books that I've read. I've many times in my life tried to make such a list, but then if it's physical or digital, I always misplace it or forget it, or get kind of stressed out about having to remember one more little box to tick that I just kind of displace it. So I spent some time remembering some books that I have read that might have interesting stories tied to them. But I don't want to say that this is like a definitive list of my most important books or anything.
Very
like
well.
That.
Disclaimer noted.
But a good place to start is maybe with The Hobbit. That was one of the first books that I read when I did learn to read, and I liked it so much that I never read the last chapter, so that I would always have something to come back to like to have more of this book. And I still have never read the last chapter.
What do you have to come back to? This just sounds like a terrible plague upon your life as a reader, always wondering how The Hobbit ends.
Well, now I'm... I'm totally drawing a blank on who dies, but there's somebody who dies in the very last chapter, which I did discover while reading The Fellowship of the Ring many years later. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I just really liked it and thought, I can reread this one day and then still have more to discover. Mm. So that's still on my list of things to do one day.
It's like leaving the last cookie in the mm-hmm. back of the
yeah,
cookies.
Exactly. Yeah, precisely. Yeah.
All right. What else? What were other big books in your life? And we can talk about like young life versus like more mm-hmm. like modern adulthood. We can separate between fiction and nonfiction. My list is dominated by nonfiction. I know mm-hmm. that I read more fiction as a kid, but I've mostly forgotten it. And the stuff that stands out for me is nonfiction.
I've definitely read more fiction. And that's also more of what is on the kind of haphazard list that I've thrown together.
Yeah. So what's on there?
But I can a work of nonfiction that I that influenced me to some degree was Godel Escher Bach.
Oh yeah.
Which I definitely never finished because I got to a part where there was it's quite a bit of algebra that I didn't really understand, and rather than continuing, I thought, I'll kind of level up in math and then come back to this book, which I have yet to do. But it's in that book that I first learned about the concept of recursion, which I don't think I actually have a good enough grasp of to really explain confidently podcast.
And Godel Escher Bach is, I tried to read that, and I think I read the first 50 pages sometime around college also, because it's just one of those like sexy, like open your mm-hmm. mind up to a whole world of thought. In this case, like math and music and what was the third thing? Godel Escher Bach. We should be able to figure this out.
Art. Well, visual art. It's yes. M.C. Escher's. Yeah.
Yes.
The
yes.
Eternal Golden Braid. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is like an alliterative rhyme too. It's GEBEGB.
Yeah, the things that author did with in that book, it was one of those like watershed moments of like, wow, like books don't just have to be dry. They don't have to be just a story.
Right.
Like you can mess with people. You can you can
manipulate. Yeah, and there's a bunch of interesting kind of like lore about it too. Because when he wrote it in the 70s. He also typeset it himself, which is pretty unusual for an author to do. And so I think there's also like some kind of hidden riddles in that people can discover. But anyway, that reading that book is when I first encountered kind of the idea of at least like popping out the way a lot of people write computer code is that you're writing a set of instructions And then if there's an instruction within that set of instructions, you kind of like pop out a line, kind of like when you hit tab and when writing an email or whatever, the text kind of moves to the right. And you can keep doing that if there's an instruction within the instruction within the instruction, right? After encountering that idea, I was like, what a lot of my life is about is just like if you pop all the way down, I'm just trying to find time to read. And all of the other things that I'm doing are just kind of popped out of that. Like having a job to save up money to, this was as a teenager when I was still living at home, to, save up money to move out or to travel or later in life to pay rent and buy groceries and stuff like that. And like doing laundry and like all of the kind of small objectives that I had were all just to service this greater goal, this like this highest level instruction, which was just find time and peace of mind to keep reading.
That is profound, Liam. I am shocked that you told me earlier you think you might not be the right person for this interview to talk about reading. Like you have oriented your entire life around just creating time
Well,
and
I don't know
space
if that's
for
true
reading.
anymore. It was true at the time.
All
I
right,
think
we're going to get into
teenagers.
our modern reading habits soon enough, but give me a few more titles of books that really stand out to you as a reader in your life.
Maybe Mindstorms, if we're sticking with nonfiction, that is Seymour Papert's 1980 book Mindstorms, which is about constructionism. The pedagogy built on constructivism. I read that right as I was moving to Denmark to work at the Lego Foundation. And Lego funded a lot of the work that Seymour Papert did at MIT. And so when they later made a robotic Lego set together, they named it after this book, Mindstorms, which is about this pedagogy. And I mean, despite working in education for like 10 years, I've never really been good at reading books about education. I think at least in my early years, it was partially because I felt like I was living the books that people around me were talking about, like the Teenage Liberation Handbook, for example, right? Like even I did read that as like a maybe 15-year-old. I remember reading it and being like, yeah. Why did I spend time, reading this? I already know this stuff. I think maybe that turned me off reading about education to a certain extent because it just seemed like preaching to the choir,
Yeah,
like the
like
book was
you're in the
preaching to
thick
me,
of
the
it.
choir.
Yeah, like most books about education or alternative education are written for educators or for parents who are still in a more conventional
Right, and
path.
like right, t trying to kind of convince them. Which I like. I regret not reading more about education at a younger age or earlier in my career. Because I think there was definitely a lot of nuance in things that I missed, and so I brought up Mindstorms because I thought it just approached the question of setting up edu or learning rich experiences in a different way than I kind of had thought about previously, preparing interactions with ideas. So, like the one I think easy way to understand constructionism is that it's about making tools or play materials or toys that give children the opportunity to have a direct experience of a phenomena or an idea. So like when a kid is playing with blocks and building up a tower and knocking it down and then building up another tower with a bigger foundation and knocking that down and seeing how tall they can build it and at what angle they can place the blocks, they're experimenting directly with gravity and with friction, right? So they're learning from gravity itself. They're not learning about how things fall because somebody's telling them. But the blocks that they're throwing or building with they are affected by gravity. So the
This
aim
is the
of
underpinning of a lot of the Montessori approach with younger children also, right? It's like l learning by doing in the prepared environment.
But then where I think constructionism takes that a little bit further is approaching learning about modern ideas like programming, for example, with that same kind of pedagogical approach. Like Scratch, the programming language Scratch, was made by students of Seymour Papert, the author of Mindstorms, as a way for children to build projects in the same way that you build something with blocks, but instead of experimenting with gravity and friction and things like that, you're playing with loops and recursion and if-then statements and things like that.
Hey, back to recursion. Nice connection. Well done. I just want to hit on any other like major categories of books that have affected you. So Hobbit is literature or fantasy. Gödel Escherbach is like one of those big ideas types of books. Mindstorms is education. Any books in like the history or politics or like self-help or travel, you know, any of these other large domains that really had a big impact on you?
See, this is where I thought you were going to make me look bad, Blake, by asking questions like that. Because the answer is definitely yes. But can I answer that question on the spot or with the time that I set aside to prepare for this interview? Not exactly. I'd say that certain books like The Broom of the System, the David Foster Wallace book, it's magical realism. I guess it was an introduction to magical realism.
Oh, like
In
Gabriel
it.
Garcia Marquez.
Yeah,
100 Years of
which
Solitude.
is, yep, is also a book that I really loved.
Yeah, me too. Magical realism makes me think of one of my all-time favorite fantasy book series that I read in college. Somehow I had time to do this, which is His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman, like
I
the
almost
Golden
went there.
Compass, etc. Yeah. Yeah, I know many people's lives have been affected by this series. It's probably right up there with Lord of the Rings, and which I d did read, and Harry Potter, which I never read. Until a camper at Not Back to School Camp strong-armed me into reading the first book, and I said, "Eh." And of course, I deeply offended many teenagers who grew up learning to read through, you know, wanting to read the Harry Potter series. But His Dark Materials was this kind of, yeah, magical realism, this slightly alternate universe that just had such profound insights into human nature. I think Philip Pullman is a genius, and the audiobook of that is just
Which he reads himself,
yes,
right?
he narrates, and then there's a full cast of characters. Apparently, they had put on like a play, like an adaptation of the book in London, and they just kept the characters, the actors from the play, and they said, "We're going to
Really? Oh, I didn't
record
know
the
that.
unabridged audiobook now." And they just all sat down, and there's maybe like 10 total voice actors, and so you can hear the same people doing different characters' voices. But that, like, I've never experienced a book that's better as an audiobook than that. You know, slowly reading it and digesting it, because if you have these different people actually narrating it, wow. I think I've listened to that audiobook 3 times, and it's probably like 50 hours in total over the trilogy.
I first read them when I was, I think, 11, and I think it was probably the first time when I read the last chapter of the last of the three books. I think it was maybe the first time that I like cried while reading a book,
Ah, such a
because it is
powerful
such a
closing.
super
So
powerful ending.
tragic. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's also it there's some I know it's an important book to a lot of people I know, and for different reasons. I mean, of course, it's a I mean, in addition to it being such a beautiful and and complex and compelling story. It was one of the it came out in like 2000, right?
Yeah, right around there.
It was a yeah. And there are gay characters and a trans character in the book. But they're very subtly kind
Yeah,
of
that's right.
referred to.
Uh-huh.
And when the movie came out, the church did really react strongly to other elements of the book, and the kind of
It's not
religious.
exactly friendly to the Catholic Church.
No, but that wasn't the kind of focus point. Yeah, I know it was very kind of affirming to
Yeah.
a lot of kind of queer youth who read it in the early 2000s when there was nothing else like that really in at least children's media.
And I think just the way that he set up the universe with daemons being these externalized voices, which are often like an opposing gender. It's just like, anyways, genius book. We shouldn't spend the whole time dwelling on his dark
Well,
materials.
actually, since we're on that
Yeah.
topic, have you, Philip Pullman has been for the past like 10 years writing a follow-up trilogy. Have you read the latest one?
I read the Book of Dust and I wasn't that impressed and I stopped there.
The first one.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so it's the Book of Dust is in three parts, and the second part, I think, is very it much well worth.
Okay.
Okay, this is just a personal recommendation to you, Blake. He opens it up with this kind of appeal to his fan or to the readers, being like, yeah, I know the first one was totally not what you wanted, but sometimes you just need to set some things up
All right,
for the
Pullman.
next
All right.
story.
You have a lot
And
of
I,
goodwill on credit, so
yeah,
I'll give you a shot. We'll talk in a moment about how we choose to continue books or to put them down if we're not feeling them. But first, I wanted to share with you the what I came up with preparing for this episode. I realized that there were so many books that were so influential on me on a very narrow time window, essentially age 17 to 25. The books that continue to resonate through my life and that I often will come back to or realize at this moment, how deeply they've shaped my direction, really hit in the late teens and early 20s for me. And I'm not going to talk much about the education books because I've talked about them a lot on other interviews already. But there's John Taylor Gatto, Grace Llewellyn, Teenage Liberation Handbook, all the Sudbury Valley School books. There was one book which sometimes you have like a super influential book at the moment, and then you put it down and you never think about it again. But you know that it was so powerful at that one moment, but it doesn't have like long-term like reread ability. For me, that was a book called The Happy Child. Did you ever see that? No.
Yeah, I think I can picture the cover, but
Yeah,
I have
yeah.
not read
There's a happy child on the cover. Spoiler.
it. Okay.
Yeah, that was all around age like 20, 21. But around the same time, I was reading stuff, a bit more classic stuff, like Walden was a huge influence on me. I was reading Fast Food Nation that turned me into a vegetarian for 10 years, and other like current issues and social critique was starting to I was starting to have an appetite for that. I was really into Jack Kerouac, and I have to admit that I continue to be into Jack Kerouac. Just the volumes turned down a bit, but a high school friend got me into it, and he said like, "This is the same high school friend who said, you have to watch Pulp Fiction. It's the coolest movie. This defines what cool is." He also said, you have to read On the Road. And I did read On the Road. And I was like, all right, this is pretty good. But a few years later, I read The Dharma Bums. And that is a book that I've realized it got me into a serious study of Eastern religion. It got me really into backpacking. It kind of gave the wilderness a sort of spiritual element for me. And so that one slim book was very, very influential. Might be right up there on the top. I worked my way through the rest of the Kerouac canon also, but nothing ever came close to the Dharma Bums. And maybe just a few others, just so we have a few points of reference here as we move forward. So you know that I went to college to study astronomy and physics, right? And definitely the most influential aspect of that decision was watching the movie Contact. And like I've never had a movie push me to make such a big choice in life. But I also, when I was preparing for this, remembered reading a couple super influential like popular science books as a high schooler, because I had taken a physics class that was not bad. And I thought, this is kind of interesting. And we never got into the super interesting stuff in the physics class. It was always the less interesting blocks sliding down planes. Yep. But there was one book called The Elegant Universe by this guy named Brian Greene. And I think this is a bestseller. And he was talking about like string theory. He introduced me to the weird stuff that happens in relativity. And I think maybe what Gödel, Escher, Bach was for you, this book, The Elegant Universe, might have been for me. Just sort of like I don't understand this, but this shows me how cool and interesting this world, especially like the mathematical and scientific world, can be. Mm-hmm. And then there was one other author, Paul Davies, who I realize has written tons of books about physics. I believe I read the book called Other Worlds by him, which was all about quantum mechanics and the weird things that happen on the smallest scales in the universe, and how entire particles can just blip in and out of existence and borrow energy from the quantum field because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. This was stuff that made me feel very cool when I was 16 and reading this, because I could talk about this and other people would be like, what's that? What's that? What's that? And I see now the roots of why I think I wanted to study physics and astronomy. It's because there were cool stories waiting to be told, but that is not enough to propel one into an actual career in science, where you actually have to do the math and the science and the research and publish the papers.
Put the time in.
So that's just a little sampling. I've got more, but we can talk about them.
Cool. I probably should have been jumping in, like cutting you off and stuff. I've never read any Kerouac. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll do that now. I went to the Henry Miller Library in Big Sur for a concert once, and then picked up the Kerouac book, Big Sur. And then before I started reading it, I talked to a friend of ours, I believe, Cameron Lovejoy, who is a big Kerouac fan. And he advised me not to start with Big Sur.
Excellent advice, Cameron.
And so then I just never ended up reading never any read. Kerouac.
Big Sur is... It's a sad book. It's written near the end of his life, like a lot of alcoholism. You would read that book and you would say, why does anyone think this guy is cool?
Okay, sure.
You have to have empathy built up for him before you reach that book.
Fair enough.
Anyways, maybe try On the Road, you know?
Classic. Okay, I'll get there one day.
As you reduce the number of tabs in your life. And down to just pure reading time.
Yeah.
Let's move on. Let's talk about how we read, because we've been talking about what we've read. And when I was talking about the books that I read, almost all of those were print, paperback, or hardcover books. You too?
Yeah, for the most part. Until about a year and a half ago, I got an e-reader and discovered Z Library.
Now we're talking about illegal things on this podcast. Go on.
No, that's where I download books that are in the public domain for free. A lot of times publishers will write a new introduction to a book that's in the public domain and then sell that. That's totally valid for people who want to do that.
Okay. Do not use this to download bootleg copies of electronic books that you could otherwise purchase?
Of course not, Blake.
Thank you.
But if I were to do something like that, I would find some other way to remunerate the author. But that's changed definitely my reading habits since living in Denmark. It's a bit tricky to get English language books. There are not a lot of like English language used bookstores. And the used bookstores that are here, maybe they have an English section, but it's got like the Da Vinci Code, and not much
Yes.
else.
Yes.
So otherwise, I do read a lot online, like reading articles. I read a lot of stuff on Twitter, and articles that people send me.
Yeah, and this is helpful because this conversation we're having is about reading. It's not about books. We just kind of started with books, but when I was thinking about how many books I read per month versus how many articles I read per month, I realized it's probably like a 1 to 100 ratio. Like maybe I'll read 3 books a month and I'll definitely read 10 articles a day, if not more. So that's 300 a month.
Read 10 articles a day?
I start my day reading articles. I'm really good at saving articles that pop up that in various like social media feeds, or if I'm reading, I love email newsletters that certain people send out that recommend books. And so I use Google Keep, which is like Evernote, but the free thing from Google, to just like hit a button on my browser and save an article for later. And essentially I'm never bored because I always have a list of like good long form reading, like online articles waiting for me.
You ever have to dump things from that list?
No, if it goes on the list, I will always take a real look at it. But if I read a few paragraphs and I think it's not worth my time, then I'll just stop. But no, it's no.
You're an inbox zero guy, right?
I am
Like,
an inbox zero guy.
so is your reading list also kind of like an inbox that you keep at zero?
No, I'm really chill about the reading list. It can grow long and fat, and I'm like, great, even better for me because I feel no pressing obligation to read things. It's just like I pull from it whenever I have the time and inclination. We have a very good relationship, my list of articles and I.
Nice. That's
Like
great.
we're going well, strong, like solid decade long relationship.
Wow. Using the same program? So
I think so.
that's okay. That's a really ingrained habit then. That's great.
It is. I also keep a list on Google Keep of like books to read, and so anytime that somebody recommends a book to me, I will just put it on that list, or maybe I'll go to the Amazon page and I'll save the link to the Amazon page. And because that's one of my greatest fears and regrets is if somebody recommends a book that they think would be perfect for me, and I forget about it. I just let it float out of my head. I consider that a moral sin and an unforgivable transgression.
I do too, but I'll just do it anyway and then feel
I
bad
just live with regret every day, Blake.
it. Yeah, more or less.
No, but how do you find stuff that you read? Is it through Twitter? Do you follow email newsletters? Like, do you go to, we haven't talked about libraries and bookstores yet, but like, do you idly browse? Is that a habit of yours?
In terms of finding books, I'm in a book club. We usually come up with, or the others will recommend interesting books. I definitely have like a mental list of things that I want to read, but I often forget it the second I finish the thing that I'm currently reading. So then it'll go a couple of days, and somebody will mention something, and I'll be like, oh, well, that'll be the thing that I read next, and then I'll try to track it down at the library or something. But
So haphazard, like unpredictable.
pretty much, I definitely have some like directions I want to go. Like, there's the three body problem.
I
Do you know that book?
tried twice and
Oh, really?
I could not do it. I know it's
Oh,
popular,
interesting.
but go on.
Well, I know I'll get there. I haven't even started yet, but there's a my friend Reinhardt. Every time I see him, he's like, "Oh, hey, I'm gonna get you the three body problem the next time I see you," and he's been promising to lend it to me for like a year and a half. And one day he will, and one day I'll read it.
So he's primed you.
But
That's how you get on Liam's reading list. You just
yeah.
ping, 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 ping.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll bring it up with them too. And I guess I'm interested in reading about it, like partially because I think it's an interesting story, but I also just kind of want to get to know modern Chinese pop media better. So some of it will, be influenced by that. Like, well, right now in the book club that I'm in, we're reading Mutual Aid by Peter Kropotkin, and I selected that book for our reading group or for our book club. And I haven't read much like late 19th century Russian political philosophy, so that was on my list. And I actually happened to get for Christmas, my partner Fia gave me this beautiful, newly illuminated edition of Mutual Aid that was illuminated, illustrated, and
I was
illuminated.
about to say, does it come with lighting? Is it like LED lights when you open it up?
It's not that type of illumination. It's like illumination, like the medieval term of decorating, not illustrating, but decorating pages, like around the edges of the
Oh,
pages
cool.
and making the first letter
I
nice and
had no
fancy.
idea that that word existed in that context. Cool.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Do
Yeah.
you read anything in paper form beyond books? Like, do you read print magazines anymore? Do you ever read a physical newspaper?
Yeah, I read my local newspaper quite a lot. I
What's
read
it
that every
called? Just
week.
so people know.
It's called Orhus Wednesday. Well,
Thought
on
you
the
were going to
back
say
of
something interesting in Danish. That, come on.
it's called Orhus Onsdag on the one side, and then you flip it over, and it's called Lokalavisen, the local newspaper. It's like a very, very literally titled newspaper. But it'll have articles about people are upset about speed bumps on this road, or some new restaurant opened up, or some, it'll go up to like city politics, and it'll go down to this kindergarten, found a squirrel with two heads or something. And it's great. And pretty much every week I see somebody that I know in the paper. Whenever I'm doing any kind of event in the city, I send them a press release and they pretty much copy and paste it into the newspaper and
Oh,
print it
wow.
as I wrote it.
Wow.
So I feel grateful to them for that. And I think it's really good to know what's going on in the city where I live. I'm trying to get involved like politically here. I'm on a neighborhood city or a neighborhood council's traffic advisory board. So if there's stuff about traffic, which there always is, I try to tie that to, the stuff that I'm
Yeah.
doing politically.
As a quasi-permanent traveler, I am genuinely jealous of this aspect of your life, Liam, because I find myself reading, I have subscriptions to The Atlantic and Harper's and the New York Times, and so I'm reading stuff about like big like world or country level or maybe state level issues. And to read about like kindergartners who find a squirrel with two heads, like that just doesn't happen in my life very
Sure.
often. Or to be able
Well, you
to
can
like
find lots of,
contribute. Yeah.
right, you can find lots of things like that online, but they're not really that interesting unless it's like, oh, I ride my bike past that
Yeah.
kindergarten, once a
Yeah.
week. And then
Exactly.
yeah.
There's something that I believe you read regularly that you have failed to mention, Liam. It
Hemp
involves,
dromedary.
that's right, involves another previous guest on this podcast, the His Royal Highness Ethan Mitchell, who writes the Hebdromedary, which would you consider this an email newsletter?
I think the word newsletter is thrown around, but it's not really news. I call it a weekly, or it's not really weekly anymore. I call it a essay, an essay collection.
Yeah.
But I guess it's up to the author to say what it is. Sometimes there is news about what's going on on the farm and stuff like that. That is definitely my favorite thing to read.
Yeah, like a personal friend who writes really interesting essays about weird stuff. Like it's so hard to find someone like this. It's so hard to find this source of reading in your life. It's kind of the for me, like reading articles about interesting stuff in these major publications is great, but reading articles about interesting stuff written by someone
definitely
who I know and who drops little like hints or references that I might pick up every once in a while is so, so pleasurable. And I feel like that's a really rare thing nowadays, just to have somebody who drops into your email inbox every few weeks and says, here's something cool I wrote. You might pick up on some of the references.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a couple of friends, like my old friend Rochelle, who I always wished would write a blog. Because I know they're always reading really interesting things and doing interesting things. And, you know, I'm probably not going to read all the same books that they are, but if they write a couple paragraphs about the thing they just read, then I'll definitely read that.
So,
because I trust them.
Let's talk about blogs for a second. Blogs were much bigger in the late 90s, or maybe first decade of the 2000s. And people regularly, I don't know if I can say that universally, more people were familiar with how to follow blogs and more people were attuned to using things like RSS readers, to like Google Reader, rest in peace, to follow many people's blogs at the same time. And I still love blogs and I have a different RSS reader to follow some, it's called Feedly. And, but do you still follow anyone's blogs? Like, it seems so hard to do it if you don't have a way for the content to get pushed to you, if you have to remember to go to someone's website to see if there's updates.
Yeah, I have a couple that come into my inbox, but I pretty much just archive them right away.
Why do you even subscribe to them?
Well, out of the, you know, I think out of having this vision of myself, of somebody who's, you know, leisurely sitting and going through mails and saying, oh, you know, here's this newsletter from this web developer. I'll see what they're up to. I think usually I'm kind of more in a rush when going through my inbox. And then if somebody I know has sent me an article, or if say I'm so lucky to have received a Hebdromedary that day, I'll like, you know, star it and keep it for, you know, that evening or something. Ooh, to read
the illustrious Gmail star. A great honor.
Yeah.
For those of you who want to learn more about Ethan Mitchell and the Hebdromedary, please go find that podcast episode. Liam, do you read many books at the same time, or are you a one at a time purist?
No, I usually try to keep a book of nonfiction and a book of fiction going at the same time. You know, for each of those moods. But if I don't have a deadline for the nonfiction, it often will sit.
The climate will have appreciably changed since the last time you opened it up.
Precisely. Yeah.
I find it very difficult to read two novels, two pieces of literature at the same time. Like my brain has space for one major story arc, but I can read four or five nonfiction books at the same time, especially if they're in like different categories. Different, you know, one's about environment, one's about history, and one's about politics.
It's interesting. I'll do if I'm late, since the pandemic started, Fee, my partner, and I will read books aloud to each other. And so, you know, I can have two works of fiction going at the same time if one of them's like a book I'm reading aloud and one is one that I'm reading to myself.
That is such a lovely practice to like hang out with someone who will read a book to you. Because it takes a long time to do that. Like, that's a serious commitment.
It does.
You're actually going to get through a book.
We just did His Dark Materials. All three.
What? Yeah. Really? That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I gave the Golden Compass to our friend Amos Blanton. His son turned 11, and I was like,
perfect age.
I know what he needs to read. Yeah. And that's when I saw that the second book of Dust had come out, and then I like kind of dove headfirst back into those.
Let's talk about rereading, because I mentioned that His Dark Materials is one of those rare series that I've actually read multiple times. But in general, I'm not a rereader. It's like, unless there are specific notes or quotes that I want to go back and access, just going back through a book you know, the whole thing over again, that's like a very great honor. I have done that with Kerouac. I mean, really just the Dharma Bums. Another book that was super influential on me as a traveler called Vagabonding, and the book Into the Wild also. And maybe some of the education books, but like very few get a reread. Do you do something similar? One and done?
I definitely, as a teenager, I definitely reread a lot.
A fiction?
But of fiction, yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
But I think in the, I don't know, last decade, I have not been rereading very much. Mostly just because I have less time for
Yeah.
reading, and so I, want to expand.
What do you think motivated you to reread as a kid? Reread these fiction books? Like, was it a way to like better process the story now that you knew where it was going to go?
No, I think it was more like the immersion in the feeling of the story or of the characters. Yeah. I just think that well, I don't know. I grew up without a TV, and I grew up with the radio playing more or less constantly. WNYC, the like New York public radio station.
Oh, so you grew up in 1930. Cool.
I noticed that I'm always much more kind of emotionally affected by audio stories than by video stories. Like I can see the if I see a like a TV news story about, a school shooting or something like that, it really will not kind of touch me as deeply as if I hear it on the radio. And I think a part of that is that when you get something through your ears, just like, and I would, compare this to reading to a certain extent, right? You have to kind of fill in the blanks in your imagination, and it, then can become more real in a way than if you're just seeing it.
So, just following that line of argument, do you have any concern about what appears to be a decline in the amount of book reading that, or even audiobook reading that the kids these days do as compared to short form reading on through social media, or I think TikTok is a wonderful example of where things are going, or just watching a lot of videos, just watching video content as a way to gather information instead of reading, and especially reading long form content. Do you have any worries about what seems to be a pretty evident trend in that direction?
Yeah, to a definitely to a certain extent. I think I think I'm a little bit out of touch with the kids these days, especially the kids these days in the US. But definitely some of that skepticism just comes from the way that a lot of pop media and platforms are designed to, really monopolize people's time. There's a ton of very smart people in Silicon Valley that are dedicating all of their time to just designing things in a way to get people to spend just a few more seconds or minutes on their platform, right? So, where was I going
And
with this?
well, in addition to that, like, do you find it much more difficult to sit down and read a book for an hour without distraction today than I think it's unfair to compare this to when we were reading it as kids. That's kind of a whole different world. But even just reading 10 years ago, like I it's physically difficult for me to like undertake the important act of putting my phone on Do Not Disturb and putting it in a different room, so that like that when the little moment happens, which happens every few minutes essentially of my waking day, when I think like maybe there's something important I need to check for some reason which is probably not that important. It really can wait an hour, but it feels so pressing. So my life as a book reader, I continue to read books, but it's with constant little zone outs. I'm pretty good at not letting those zone outs like reach into the minutes or you know, double digits of minutes, but still it's happening. Has this been your experience too?
Yeah, for sure. I think so. But I think another thing that can affect that, or at least it affects that for me, is living with a partner.
I don't understand. Can you flesh that out?
Blah, blah, blah.
Fia, we're about to throw you under the bus here.
I think it's also harder to dedicate time to reading when living with a partner, because there's a lot of things to discuss and coordinate around cooking dinner and planning social lives and things like that.
That's not the direction I thought you were going to go. I thought you were going to say that she keeps you honest by pointing out when you keep distracting yourself on a phone when you say you're going to be reading. But it sounds like what you're saying is just that relationships take time and energy.
Yeah. And because of our work schedules, I think the time that we spend together is also the time overlaps with the time that I spend reading.
Having a partner, does that give you better reading habits in any way? Like, are you nudged in that direction? Like if you're, I guess this could be a friend also who you're hanging out with frequently. Like, do you have discussions about books and things you're reading and that incentivizes you to read more when you might otherwise get distracted on Twitter?
I think having friends that also read a lot who I see infrequently, I think supports my reading habits. Because if there's 2 weeks between times when I see a friend, if I've finished a book since then and then have that to talk about with them, that's definitely a motivating factor.
Yeah. And you know that that'll be a question that comes up, like, what have you been reading?
Right, precisely. Yeah.
Yeah. Good point.
Yeah.
Liam, I think we should move on to one question that is dear to both of our hearts, and then another question that will hopefully embarrass both of us. The first one being, what's the role of bookstores in your life now? I have like a strong feelings about bookstores that anyways, I want you to go first though, please.
Okay. Yeah. I love bookstores. When we started this call, we had video turned on, and I didn't realize until my own camera turned on that I was wearing a T-shirt from a bookstore, from Firestorm back in Asheville, which is definitely one of my favorite bookstores in the world. That's a bookstore where I definitely looked around and found a lot of things that I wanted to read, just in dialogue with the staff and like looking at staff picks, and just looking at the covers of books in the ways that they had sorted them. Now, I guess I'll just use Asheville as a reference point, because it's the last place I lived in the U.S. where they sell a lot of English books. There's also a great used bookstore, Downtown Books and News, downtown, where I was always looking out for like DIY books, like books that are guides to making things, partially for Endor, partially just because I
the Agile Learning Center that you created.
Exactly. Yeah, I was always working on the our kind of resource library there, because you know, there are things. I actually was just talking to There are things that you can find in books that you can find on the internet, but they can be really hard to find on the internet. Like if you want to learn some specific carpentry technique, and you can't go to a carpenter to learn it from them, you might be able to find something about it on YouTube, or you might be able to find an article, but there's just going to be so much trash you have to sift through to get there. Yeah. But if you just go to a bookstore or to a library and look in their, you know, do-it-yourself section, some publisher, you know, will have really spent a lot of time collecting the relevant information, putting it together in one book. So
And for
like
something
things
like
like
carpentry, also like having a book you can just have cracked open there and nice illustrations, nice steps. Like I think that's still easier than trying to navigate through a YouTube video and going back and forth and back and forth. There are some things
definitely,
that
yeah,
books are
YouTube.
definitely more have more utility than YouTube videos, which are wonderful, but
Yeah.
they're not great for everything.
Yeah, there's lots of like tips and tricks and stuff I think you can learn on YouTube. But yeah, getting in depth or like getting like detailed instructions about things. There are just tons of really great books out there. They don't have any ads. And you could just,
Ads
you
ads
could.
are horrible. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's also no, there's no like clickbait. So many of the websites that exist now, right, are just there to up the ratings of other websites, right? Or they're there to sell ads, right? So I was trying to make curtain rods. That's what it's called. Curtain rods recently. And I spent like 15 minutes trying to find a good guide or like a collection of different designs online. And there's just so many like crap DIY websites that really had basically no information in them. They had a couple of pictures, but then it was mostly just ads. And then, things that would link to another website that would up the SEO of, that website. So I ended up just, coming up with something on my own. But had I access to a really good library, or English, had I access to a
A good bookstore.
nice a good bookstore,
That's the word.
then I probably would have gone there, or I would have already had the book.
Yeah, you're making me think of Lonely Planet guidebooks, which are not only just so visually appealing, does that big rack of blue covers in the travel section of a bookstore, but trying to gather complete travel advice for a certain country or region online, you just go through so many trashy websites and articles that are just trying to sell you things that are promoted, go to this certain place, buy this certain travel tool, and it's and Lonely Planets are have travel guidebooks in general. You could have a whole critique about them, but I still use them. Although nowadays I might just go on to their website and purchase individual PDF chapters
Ah, well,
and
that's
reference
cool.
them on my laptop instead of actually carrying the heavy book around. Yeah, and as a frequent traveler, I use a Kindle as much as I can, d despite my deep love of feeling books, smelling books. And I don't know what the appropriate term for this kind of binding is, Liam. Maybe you know this, but the books that have, it's more often novels, that they kind of have a jagged edge on the far edge of the pages. So when you look at it, it kind of goes up and down like a mountain range, and it's actually not that easy to flip to a specific page. You have to more leaf through them. I love those books. Like Kindle will never be able to recreate that. And when they do, I will sign up for the metaverse. I'm in. Let's talk about books we have loved in the past that we now are kind of embarrassed by. And instead of putting you on the spot, Liam, I will go first. I volunteer as tribute. Okay, let's see. First, there's a business book, very famous, The 4-Hour Workweek, which I read right after it came out, I think in 2007. I actually used many elements of that book in my first book, College Without High School. There's even I think a subchapter in College Without High School called like the 6-hour school week or something like that, making the argument that you should, do all your important academic stuff in just a few hours a week and spend the rest of your time unschooling and going on adventures and doing stuff out in the real world. And I don't know how you feel, but any book that I loved in the past and now feel kind of embarrassed by it, it's always with a mixture of emotions. It's like there are always elements of these books that I still love and I still, defend. And for example, in the 4-hour work week, I was introduced to the concept of taking mini retirements. And Tim Ferriss, the author, essentially said, stop planning to you know, work all the best years of your life and then go retire. Instead, take these like multi-month mini retirements spaced out through your whole life. And you know, it was a way to validate my desire to never have a normal full-time job. And I'm still appreciative to him for that. But then there's all these other aspects of the book that just feel so smarmy to me now, like hiring all these you know, virtual helpers from India to like, you know, answer your emails for you. And anyways, there's just aspects of the book that are very kind of materialistic and money grubbing. And I don't feel totally proud, but I can't totally write the book off either. Let's see. Another one is I had a serious Ayn Rand phase. This was like early to mid 20s. I think when I was in high school, one of the optional summer reading books was Anthem, which is her shortest book and probably her least like controversial book. It's, you know, it's a dystopian future in which everyone just has a number and you're not allowed to say the word like I. So it's, you know, uber collectivist dystopia. And I was like, yeah, that's okay. And then I think nudged in this direction by my dad, I picked up The Fountainhead and was like, this was like, okay. And then I read Atlas Shrugged. And I remember reading somewhere that in some major survey of American readers that Atlas Shrugged is like the number two most, I don't know if it's like most popular or rated most influential book behind like the Bible in America. And I was like, I got to give this book a chance. And I mean, what a beast. That thing's like more than 1,000 pages of novel, which is often not well written. It's just like, it's blocky. There's a reason that people say like, oh, that's a book that like 17-year-olds read and then they grow up. From a literature standpoint, I definitely see the critique. But from a sort of political philosophy standpoint, when I was curious to hear like the best possible defenses of capitalism and of, you know, more like conventional economic notions. And I still think that no one has done a better job of communicating these basic ideas, and especially basic economic ideas about money, and kind of the ideal of what a capitalist, you know, a classic liberal society could be. I think that no one has done a better job than her. And so this relationship I have again with these books. Like, I'm a bit embarrassed to say that this was an influential book on me, and at the same time, I still feel like I have something to defend there. All right, Liam, that was my vulnerable moment. You want to pile on here? You want to?
Yeah, of course. I've wanted to read Atlas Shrugged for a really long time because I think that I probably disagree with a lot of it. But I'm curious, what do you? Let's talk about it after I've read it.
Okay.
When I saw this question, a book that jumped out at me was Anti-Fragile by Nassim Taleb.
Yeah.
But like, I started reading it and was just like super into it. I got it at Firestorm, the bookstore previously mentioned, that had at the time a cafe attached to it. So I would like work out of my laptop there one day a week or something. And where I picked it up there and like read the first chapter and was just like super into it. And I kept on saying to people like, oh, you gotta check out this book. It's sick. It's like, it's about this idea that, you know, some things, when you stress them, they become stronger instead of breaking. It's like the reverse of fragility. And then I read like another chapter of it and then was sitting next to somebody on a bus who also happened to be reading it. And I was like, oh, you're also reading this book. It's great, right? And she was like, oh, is it? And then I was like, huh, okay, she's not that into it. And I like, that was like the first crack. And then I read a couple more chapters and was just like, oh God, like, where is he going with this? Like, suddenly turned into a bunch of like investing advice. And then I
It's
suddenly was
written in
just like,
such a compelling way, right?
oh, it
And
really is.
it's
Yeah.
like great, like snappy phrases and the chapter
Yeah.
titles.
Yeah. And then I suddenly was like, oh, I've just tied my reputation to this book, and like told a whole bunch of people that I know and respect that I think this is really cool. So I kind of stopped reading it. I never finished it. But I hope that all of the people I recommended it to didn't read it. Anyway, then I guess another one would maybe be Infinite Jest.
David Foster Wallace, considered a
David
classic.
Foster
Well,
Wallace.
why be embarrassed, Liam?
I guess just because it's like, like a couple of years after I read it, like I kept on seeing memes about people who talked about having read it. Because it's like, it's really big. It's a big book, and there's lots of footnotes, and it's kind of hard to get through. And I think a lot of people that read it maybe like talk about the fact that they've read it a lot. And then it just made me want to like never mention that
Like I've never read Ulysses by James Joyce,
read
but I
it.
feel like this is one of those books that's just so long and difficult that people just name drop it to flex on others to be like, look at what a badass reader I am. Did you feel like you were being associated with this crowd of people who flex with saying they read long books?
Pretty much. And it was actually, so the book was recommended to me by an old friend, Dave Thomas, who he said, like, I read this book and, don't be an asshole about it, or like, don't be a dick about
Great.
it. And
Great
so I think
advice,
from the
Dave.
very beginning, yeah, from from the very beginning, I was kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, I think this is probably a book that people don't actually talk about. And so I definitely tried to do that as little as possible. Yeah. Otherwise, embarrassing. I'm trying to think of what else. There's probably some like, yeah, some of those like British teen novels I read as a teenager that I'd be maybe embarrassed about.
I've got one more.
Yeah.
There's a book by this anarchist collective called Crime Think, and the title is Days of War, Nights of Love. And I put this book in this is like the anarchist version of like Ayn Rand. It's not literature, but it's more like practical suggestions for how to like steal stuff. How to be like a anarchist crust punk, essentially. And with like these kind of light kind of activism prescriptions, nothing that would really like, force you to dedicate your life to activism, but just more like Mary Prankster style stuff. And what I'm embarrassed by is that I didn't read this book at like age 16, which I think would be much more excusable, but I was like 23 or 24, and I was like, yeah, man, I'm gonna go steal soy milk. And like just like half a second later, I was like, wait, what am I doing? Like I was totally convinced by this book that like doing this stuff, which I don't consider ethical, is pretty cool. Like let's go stick it to the man. It was just way too far down that way for me, and I was way too old to be like taking that stuff seriously.
I bought that book as a teenager, I think, but I never read it.
Oh, well,
But
you can
maybe,
always go back. You
I'll
can always be
I gotta
convinced to
yeah,
shoplift your
now I'm
soy milk.
for sure.
That
I
will
would, but
reform
to
the system.
the isn't kind of the reverse, or the anarchist version, or not version, the kind of antithesis to Atlas Shrugged is The Dispossessed by Ursula Le Guin, isn't it?
I wish I'd read more Ursula K. Le Guin, and I have not.
I can't believe we haven't talked about her until now. I think she's maybe my favorite author.
Wow. All
And
right.
The Dispossessed is I think one of her best books. That's kind of about this, it's a work of sci-fi. It's about these people who live on this kind of barren planet, but they live in a what she calls an ambiguous utopia of mutual aid and free association. So it paints this really a beautiful and complex picture of kind of what a what a fully anarchist or fully communist society could look like. And it goes down into details that I definitely spent a lot of time like talking about as a teenager with people. And I wish I had read this book then, because to the question of like, who's gonna take out the trash, she suggests that every 10th day, even if you're a, physics professor, which the main character of this book is, you spend a day doing work like taking out the trash, because it's got to be like nobody necessarily wants to dedicate their life to it, but it's got to be done. So having like chore days, but on a, national level.
Well, we can discuss this separately from the podcast. My mom recommended Ursula K. Le Guin to me, and maybe even The Dispossessed. And I think she even got me the book when I was a teenager, and I just didn't read it. And I was like too busy reading Michael Crichton or something. And I feel bad, but this makes me realize two things. One, having parents that will recommend specific books that don't suck to you, like what a game changer. Like what a true privilege. And both my mom and my dad filled those roles.
Totally. Yeah, it sounds like in very different ways too. If your dad suggested Ayn Rand and your mom suggested Ursula Le Guin, there's definitely some different perspectives there.
the second thing that I just remembered is when we were talking about bookstores, I grew up in the 90s when Barnes and Noble and Borders were huge and expanding and competing with each other, and these stores with tens of thousands of square feet of retail space for books were just so common. And there's still Barnes and Noble in the US right now, but there's not as many. Borders is out of business. Amazon is the reason, long story short. And I remember the feeling that it was different from a library feeling, but the feeling of wandering through the aisles of a Barnes and Noble, and these sections would be so big. The science section would be, 10 feet long with five racks vertical of books. Like it was, and it was all they were all new books in a way that I couldn't find in a library. Like there'd be a few new titles, but usually the new titles were already checked out, and it's more difficult to get them. And so those kinds of big box retail stores had such a profoundly positive influence on me. And especially since my parents were like, essentially, if they were convinced that I was going to read a book, they would buy the book for me. I wasn't bringing home, fancy hardcover, coffee table books that cost $60. Paperback books, I had essentially an unlimited allowance for those. And so what a perfect incentive system. Liam, let's talk about some little tiny nitty-gritty things. Do you write inside your paperback books?
I really want to, but usually I'm just like not sitting in a way that is conducive to that. But you know what? I did write quite a lot in Infinite Jest when I was reading it. Here I go talking about it.
Jeez.
Because there's a bunch of the book that's in French and just like some conversations here and there. And so I like took out my phone and got out the Google Translate app and just like wrote word for word all of these French sentences, translated them to English, and then wrote them in the page margins so that whoever read the book next wouldn't have to do
Very
that.
thoughtful.
It was kind of a nice like exercise to do while reading it too. But
So aside
no,
from
I really
translating French, do you write like notes to yourself? Do you annotate?
I want to, and I've told myself like, oh, you should, at the back of the book, you should, write some notes. I just don't. I don't, but not because I think it's wrong or anything like that. I really appreciate finding other people's notes and stuff like that when I find them in these books. I always write, if I'm giving a book as a gift, I always write a little dedication in the beginning.
I like writing just little words or notes on the side so I can quickly flip through and find a specific reference. And but I don't highlight books and I don't underline sentences, but I will draw a vertical line along the side of a block of text if I wanted to that you can easily reference it. And I'll do that liberally. I'll just keep doing it, and then when I go back through the book later, I can really easily find the stuff that felt most compelling to me.
That's a really unobnoxious way of doing that. Sometimes if I'm reading a used book and like somebody's underlined text, that will bother me,
Yeah,
or highlighting too.
it's hard to underline well. You end up like doing strike through for half of the text, and then you're just an asshole.
Yep, you think you're as good as a word processor, but you're not.
Do you hold on to books? Do you nest with your book collection, or do you give them away?
I do, because I really like being able to reference them and lend them. And for a lot of my life, I've been like collecting books for the educational institution that I'll open one day or open again one day. So I keep books for that purpose, but like moving across the Atlantic 3 times is not super conducive to collecting books. So I most of my books are like in boxes in my parents' basement in Connecticut. But the books that I have amassed here, I will keep until maybe one day I won't anymore. But for the most part, I keep and lend.
I love lending, and I am much more likely to read a book if it's been lent to me. It just feels like there's a natural time constraint there. So that's a good accountability life hack right there, Liam, for
Sometimes I'll even buy it, like oh, you know what? I lent this to you, I think, as a matter of fact. There was a book about it was called the trans I think it's called the Transportation Power Structure or something. And it's really thin, so I bought like 3 or 4 copies of it just so I could lend them out to people. I thought it was kind of an eye-opening book about how urban development is influenced by cars specifically, and how class plays into that. I think your critique was, if I remember correctly, I don't know if you remember this, that it was written in like very leftist insider language.
Yes, the
Solid.
master's degree requirement in order to pierce even one paragraph. I am pretty harsh on anything written in such language.
But it wasn't academic. It was for the people who had read Days of Love, Nights of War, I think.
Okay. Who
Which
also
is
happen
maybe
to
its
have
own type of
master's
academic.
degrees. All right, this conversation has gone on longer than I anticipated. You are the perfect guest for this episode, Liam.
I don't know about that, Blake. Do you how
Listen,
much
I could have had Ethan on, but he would just intimidate people. Like, the man's an alien.
No, but he real. Oh, wait. Yeah, why did he have him
Listen.
talk about reading? He reads. I would. You know what? I feel like there's more to learn from him talking about reading, though.
Listen, again, please go check out the Ethan Mitchell episode about being a polymath. But I've got you, Liam, and you have started an Agile Learning Center. You've worked with a lot of teen unschoolers. You've worked with teens at Not Back to School Camp. And of course, you were unschooled yourself. And so I want to wrap this up by talking a little bit about reading and the overlap with self-directed education and unschooling. I actually want to start with higher education. I wanted to start talking about college. And you never went to college. You've dropped in on some college level things, but you did not do a bachelor's degree. I recently heard someone describe the liberal arts college experience, so like not going for a science or highly technical degree, but the broad liberal arts experience as essentially being a system to incentivize young people to read and to discuss hard books. And when I read that, I thought, that's true. That feels very true to me. It's at the end, kind of like your recursion theory about your life here. Like, there's lots of stuff that might happen in academics in college, but it seems like at the root, what people are going there for is to be put in this environment that, I won't use the word force, but heavily incentivizes and promotes reading and discussing difficult books that you're much less, you know, this is what we'll talk about, you are less likely to read and discuss or even find opportunities to read and to discuss in life outside of the higher education institution. How does this strike you? And from your perspective, as someone who has read a lot, and in my opinion, is good at reading hard books, and it did not go through higher education, how do you think this can be reproduced if this is what college is selling at the end of the day?
I mean, I think there definitely are strategies for this, committing to keeping a blog where you write about each book that you read, or joining a book club. But then it just becomes another question of how to, continuously motivate yourself to read hard things. And if you just pile more work on top of that, it can even get harder, right? Like, oh, now I have to read this. I have to read Foucault and write about it and like publish a blog post about it.
It's easy to give up on that. Like, you can have these lofty ideals as a self-directed learner to read a book every month and to write a blog post about it. But at the end of the day, are you saying you see some value in the external motivation system that people sign up for with college in this regard?
Yeah, definitely. Just because of definitely because that's currently the water that we swim in, right?
Yeah, if you want to find people who want to read and discuss these books, then college is probably the best place to go to find them. Like, it's more difficult to convene a book club of people who have the motivation and the free time to discuss these kinds of books.
Like, if there are really, if there's important field related, or if you want to read more within a field that you're working in, maybe, and you're like really spiteful, you can motivate yourself to read books and then call out, your colleagues, and to call out your boss by having read something that they should have read.
I don't know if I can ethically promote this as a reading strategy, Liam, but I'll take your word for it.
No, I feel like I didn't really deliver that very well.
Maybe that's for the best.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, Blake. Good question.
Okay.
Too good.
Too good. Okay, well, now let's talk about the K-12 realm. And you ran an Agile Learning Center in Asheville, North Carolina for a while, and you've worked at Not Back to School Camp. And my question for you essentially is, like, how foundational do you think reading and the love of reading, and again, this, we can be talking about books, we can be talking about other forms of reading, how foundational is that for self-directed learners who want to, I'm not even sure what the metric is here, who want to be well-rounded, who want to feel like they know something about the world? You know, earlier we did our episode about who should unschool and who shouldn't. If someone has, zero desire to read, but maybe they still watch YouTube videos, let's say, and they are not part of any sort of, educational system or school or family that incentivizes reading, like, does that make you worried at all about self-directed learning and self-directed learners?
To a certain extent, yeah. I think there's something special about the level of depth that you can get to in a subject by reading a book about it, that you can't necessarily get to by watching a YouTube video or a string of YouTube videos. And there's also something about, I think, like, practicing continued focus over a longer period of time on getting to a deeper level of understanding of something. We did a workshop at Indoor once about newspapers, and I was so psyched at the end of the day when we kind of went around and did our reflections. The one person who came to my how to read a newspaper workshop checked out by saying, "Yeah, I learned how to, we're like, why it's important to read newspapers, and that's because there's no recommendation algorithm in your newspaper, and you get to decide, you know, what you spend, like what you find in the newspaper and spend time reading." He said it, I don't know, it seemed really profound when he said it. You know,
Yeah,
like
no, it does
a
sound
digital
profound.
native kind of saying
Yeah.
that, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Like I can just pick up a major newspaper and flip through it and decide what I want to read. Like it's not like based upon all your previous reading, where now here's what you're going to read next.
But and I think there's something about like being at a professional level, right? I do some work with the university here and spend a lot of time just hanging out with academics. And you know, they're just reading all the time. And so if you want to be at the cutting edge of some field, you know, you kind of there's not really a better way to be updated about it than to be reading journal articles and the books that people are publishing. I mean, even if it's down to like AI art, right? So if you're really into GAN algorithms that are, you know, computer programs that are making these weird paintings and things like that, you can get pretty far with podcasts and YouTube videos. But if you want to be learning about the stuff that's going to be in a YouTube video 2 years down the line, that's already been published, but it's in a journal article. And somebody else will read it and then turn it into a, you know, easy to digest podcast, maybe, in 2 years. But it's kind of going to be old news by then. So if you want to be really up to date, you know, I think you need to follow people that are at the cutting edge of that field. Like that's one of the things that I really love about Twitter is that people will post their own articles there, right? And the stuff that they're reading. And then you can see what they're up to and what they're thinking about. And
Yeah.
so to, yeah.
I think that's really well said. Like if you want to be on the cutting edge of anything, I mean to me books are just like crystallized conversations with an
Yeah.
author. And for better or worse that they're stuck at one moment in time, but to have a sustained conversation with a smart person who's going to lay out some complicated set of ideas or arguments like that, you know, before the printing press that you really had to be part of the privileged few to have access to the you know whatever whoever the philosophers were and now you know that's just there, it's sitting there waiting for us in the form of books and so if you want to find out what's going on in the world that's cool or what's about to happen you need to have conversations with smart people and that's what books represent and it's this like virtuous circle of you know you read. You kind of have these private conversations with the authors of the books, and that allows you to then participate in the contemporaneous discussion of what's going on. That lets you go to Endor Agile Learning Center or Not Back to School Camp and participate in a workshop about climate change because all of a sudden you have some actual, you know, authority on the subject. And to me, that's the most exciting, you know, part of all of this. It's the reason to read. You know, because then you get to feel like you're participating in the interesting stuff that's going on in the world. And if you don't read, then it limits, it puts a cap on how much interesting stuff you get to access in the world. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
But maybe you and I are just dinosaurs already, Liam, and we are just
Hey.
expressing our biases towards the written word, and it's
I think it's there's I think publishing books is not the publishing a book is not the best way to communicate an idea. Because I
doesn't
think
that
if
contradict
you
everything we just said?
what I'm getting at is like if somebody wants to popularize an idea, And they have the resources. They're probably not just going to publish a book. They're going to make, they'll make a string of YouTube videos. They'll make a podcast that's well produced. Maybe they'll make a documentary. Maybe they'll make an interactive website where you can interact with like the data that they're using, so that it's easier for people to get a hold of those ideas. But most people don't have. A lot of the people that are having really interesting ideas don't have the resources to make those interactive web
Yeah,
pages
the
and publish
time
all these
or
YouTube
the
videos.
know-how. Yeah.
Or the, right. And so what they're doing is publishing books. So if you want to know what they're thinking about, then, the onus is kind of on you to find what they've written and read that.
Liam, to wrap up, as a grown unschooler and a late reader and now a frequent reader, do you have any advice for younger self-directed learners or unschoolers who are perhaps still like reading cautious or reading skeptical? Like any advice about like why reading is awesome or how it's been the most fun experience that it could be in your life?
Yeah, I wouldn't say reading is fun. Like, it's not, it's not jumping through hoops in a video game. Like, it's compelling and interesting. It's exposing yourself to new ideas and ways of thinking about things and encountering situations that are described by authors. So I would say, yeah, don't look to reading to be fun. Look to it to be interesting.
Do you have any favorite tools as a reader? Like, I don't know, a library card
Yeah,
or.
definitely a library card and I think a Twitter account. Even just alert, like get a Twitter account. Don't post anything, but find some people that are writing about a field that you find interesting, and then find the people that are kind of at the cutting edge of that and see what they're posting and what they are reading themselves. And oftentimes, you can just ask them questions if there's something about their work that you don't understand or don't agree with. Especially if you find somebody who is in a field, who's writing about a field that you find interesting that you disagree with, read something they've written and then comment a good question to something that they've published on one of their tweets and see what happens.
Liam Nelson, as always, it's a pleasure to have you on Off Trail Learning.
Thanks for having me, Blake.